7. The quietest places in the world. While on my expedition to record singing sand dunes, I experienced something quite rare. Complete silence. The scorching summer heat kept visitors away. Most of the time, my recording companion, Diane Hope, and I were on our own. We camped at the foot of Kelso Dunes, in a barren, scrubby valley with dramatic granite hills behind us. Virtually no planes flew overhead, and only very occasionally did a distant car or freight train create noise. The conditions were wonderful for recording. No noise meant there was no need for second takes. Much of the day, however, there was a great deal of wind, which often whistled past my ears. But at twilight and early in the morning, the winds calmed down, and the quiet revealed itself. Overnight I heard the silence being interrupted only once, when a pack of nearby coyotes howled like ghostly babies, unnerving me with their near musical whistling and chattering. High up on the dune, early on the second morning, I was waiting for Diane to set up some recording equipment. Since she was some distance away, I had a chance to contemplate real silence. The ear is exquisitely sensitive. When perceiving the quietest murmur, the tiny bones of the middle ear, which transmit sound from the eardrum to the inner ear, vibrate by less than a thousandth of the diameter of a hydrogen atom. Even in silence, tiny vibrations of molecules move different parts of the auditory apparatus. These constant movements have nothing to do with sound. They stem from random molecular motion. If the human ear were any more sensitive, it would not hear more sounds from outside. Instead, it would just hear the hiss generated by the thermal agitation of the eardrum, the stapes bone of the middle ear, and the hair cells in the cochlea. On the dunes, I could hear a high-pitched sound. It was barely audible, but I worried that I might be experiencing tinnitus, that is, ringing in the ears, perhaps evidence of hearing damage caused by my excessively loud saxophone playing. Medics define tinnitus as perceiving sound when there is no external source. For 5 to 15% of the population, tinnitus is constant, and for 1 to 3% of people it leads to sleepless nights, impaired performance at tasks, and distress. Theories of tinnitus abound, but most experts agree that it is caused by some sort of neural reorganization triggered by diminished input from outside sounds. Hair cells within the inner ear turn vibrations into electrical signals, which then travel up the auditory nerve into the brain. But this is not a one-way street. Electrical pulses flow in both directions, with the brain sending signals back down to change how the inner ear responds. In a silent place, or when hearing is damaged, auditory neurons in the brainstem increase the amplification of the signals from the auditory nerve to compensate for the lack of external sound. As an unwanted side effect, spontaneous activity in the auditory nerve fibers increases, leading to neural noise, which is perceived as a whistle, hiss, or hum. Maybe what I was hearing on the dunes was the idling noise of my brain while it searched in vain for sounds. One thing I noticed was that this high-frequency whistle was not always there. Maybe a sign that, after a while, my brain habituated to the noise. In contrast to the variable silence on the dunes, at my university there is an anechoic chamber, a room that provides unchanging, guaranteed silence, uninterrupted by wind, animals, or human noise. The anechoic chamber never fails to impress visitors, even though the entrance is utilitarian and uninspiring. Just outside the entrance they see dusty metal walkways, and nearby, builders are often making lots of noise constructing test walls in a neighboring laboratory. These walls will be analyzed for how well they keep sound from passing through them. Guarding the anechoic chamber are heavy, gray metal doors. In fact, you have to go through 3 doors to reach the chamber, because it is a room within a room. To make the place silent, several sets of heavy walls insulate the innermost room, stopping outside noise from entering. Like a modern concert hall, the chamber is mounted on springs to prevent unwanted vibration from getting into the inner sanctum. The chamber is the size of a palatial office. First-time visitors are usually circumspect, not least because the wire floor is like a taut trampoline. Once inside, with the doors closed, they noticed vast wedges of grey foam covering every surface, including the floor beneath the wire trampoline. When showing visitors around, I like to say nothing at this point because it is fun to watch the realization sweep across their faces as they adjust to this unbelievably quiet space. But it is not silent. Your body makes internal noises that the room cannot dampen. Sound recordist Chris Watson described his experience in such a chamber. There was a hissing in my ears and a low pulsing that I can only guess was the sound of my blood circulating. The internal noises are not the only oddity. The foam wedges on the floor, ceiling, and walls absorb all speech. There are no acoustic reflections. We are used to hearing sound bouncing off surfaces, floor, walls, and ceiling, which is why a bathroom is lively and reverberant, and a bedroom muffled and subdued. In the anechoic chamber, speech sounds very muffled, like when your ears need to pop in an airplane. According to the Guinness Book of Records, the anechoic chamber at Orfield Laboratories in Minneapolis is the quietest place in the world, with a background noise reading of minus 9.4 decibels. But how quiet is that? If you chatted with someone, your speech would measure around 60 decibels on a sound level meter. If you stood quietly on your own in a modern concert hall, the meter would drop down to a level of about 15 decibels. The threshold of hearing, the quietest sound a young adult can hear, is about 0 decibels. The test room at Orfield Laboratories, like the chamber at Salford University, is quieter than that. An anechoic chamber has an impressive silence because it simultaneously presents two unusual sensations. Not only is there no external sound, but the room puts your senses out of kilter. Through their eyes, visitors obviously see a room, but they hear nothing that indicates a room. Add the claustrophobic drama of being enclosed behind three heavy doors, and some begin to feel uneasy and ask to leave. Others are struck with fascination at the oddness of the experience. I know of no other architectural acoustic space that regularly has such a strong effect on people. But it is remarkable how quickly the brain gets used to the silence and the contradictory messages from the senses. The exotic sensory experience is filed in memory, and the extraordinary becomes more normal. The magical impact of the first visit to an anechoic chamber is never really experienced again. Not only are anechoic chambers very rare, but our brains ensure that the experience is mostly ephemeral. However, there is more to silence than experiencing the quietest rooms on earth. Silence can be spiritual. It can even have an aesthetic and artistic quality, as epitomized in John Cage's famous silent composition, 4:335. When one of my teenage sons learned I was going to see this piece performed, he expressed shock that I would spend money to hear nothing. Cage composed the piece in 1952 after a visit to the anechoic chamber at Harvard University. There, surrounded by thousands of fiberglass wedges, he had expected to find silence. But it was not entirely quiet, because of the noises within his own body. He also described hearing a high-frequency sound that might very well have been caused by tinnitus. The performance of 4:335 that I heard took place 9 months before my trip into the desert. It was carried out with all the usual pomp and ceremony of a normal concert. The house lights were dimmed, and the musician strode on stage and bowed to the applause from the audience. He then sat down at the piano, adjusted the seat to make it just the right height, turned the page on the score, opened the keyboard lid of the piano, closed it again, and started a timer. Nothing else happened, apart from the occasional turning over of the empty sheet music, and the opening and closing of the keyboard lid to signify the end and beginning of the three movements. At the end, the pianist opened the keyboard lid for one last time, stood up to accept the applause of the audience, bowed, and left. Amusingly, the work comes in different orchestrations, and I guess the full orchestra version is very popular with the musicians' union, maximizing the number of people being paid to play no notes. The first surprise occurred before the pianist entered the stage. As the doors of the auditorium were closed and the house lights dimmed, I felt a sudden frisson of excitement, even greater than I get before a normal concert. A modern concert hall is one of the quietest places to be found in a city. At the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, England, tour guides like to recount the story that when the largest peacetime bomb ever detonated in Great Britain exploded in 1996, workers within the auditorium did not hear the bang because the hall was so well isolated from the outside world. Planted by the Irish Republican Army, IRA, in the city centre, the bomb destroyed shops, broke virtually every window within a kilometre, half-mile radius, and left a 5-metre-wide, 16-foot crater. It is worth taking the backstage tour of a modern concert hall to see the precision needed to achieve the noise isolation. The tour guides are usually very proud of the fact that the auditorium is built on springs. Like a souped-up car suspension, the springs stop vibration from entering the concert hall. If ground vibration were to set parts of the auditorium moving, the tiny vibrations of the hall would set air molecules into motion, creating audible noise. Everything connected to the hall that might transmit vibration, electricity cables, pipes, and ventilation ducts, have to be carefully designed with their own little suspension systems. The attention to detail is staggering. In recent decades, classical concert halls have been built to be quieter and quieter, giving conductors and musicians access to the widest possible dynamic range to exploit and create drama. In a good modern hall, the collective noise from audience members breathing and shuffling in their seats is actually louder than any background sounds from outside noises or ventilation systems. What the audience hears during a performance of 4:335 depends on the isolation of the auditorium and the quietness of the audience. The hall I was in did not have the best sound insulation, and I could occasionally hear buses on the busy road outside. The audience was small, about 50 people, whom I could hear fidgeting and coughing. With these distractions, as the piece progressed, I found my mind wandering. But were these really distractions, or the actual music? Although there was a musician on the stage, what Cage's piece does is shift the focus from the performers to the audience. And that change from being a passive member of the audience to being part of the performance was at the heart of my second surprise. When the piece was over, I felt a strong sense of a communal achievement with everyone else in the audience and the performer. As the audience clapped and a few shouted, "More!" and "Encore!", I had an overwhelming sense of a shared experience. We had all just done something that was completely pointless. Or was it? Moments of silence are commonly used in the arts, famously so in theatre by playwrights Harold Pinter and Samuel Beckett. For Pinter, silence forces the audience to contemplate what the character is thinking. For Beckett, silences might symbolise the meaningless and eternity of existence. Short silences are also used regularly in music. A jazz group in full flow may stop abruptly for a moment, before resuming exactly together a couple of beats later and carrying on as though the pause had never happened. The silence adds dramatic tension by subverting expectation in a way that the brain finds pleasurable. Imagine a musician walking up to a piano and repeating a snippet of a favorite melody over and over again. The predictability would soon become tedious. Similarly, one would derive little pleasure from the more random approach of letting a cat run about on the keys playing notes haphazardly. Successful music is neither completely repetitive nor entirely random. It lies somewhere between, having some regular rhythmic and melodic structure, but with changes to maintain the listener's interest. One task the brain does when listening to music is try to break down the rhythmic structure, the beat or groove. The seemingly simple task of finding and tapping along to a beat involves several brain regions and is not fully understood. The basal ganglia buried deep inside the cerebrum seem to play a role, as do the prefrontal cortex at the front of the brain and other areas used for processing sound. The basal ganglia play a vital role in initiating and regulating motor commands. When they are damaged in Parkinson's disease, patients have difficulty starting movements. As the brain decodes the information bombarding it during a tune, it is constantly attempting to predict when the next strong beat will occur. It draws on past experiences of similar music and recent notes from the piece to work out where the rhythm is going. Correctly anticipating the next strong beat is satisfying, but there is also a delight in hearing skillful musicians violate that regular tempo, subverting the listener's expectation. One way of flouting expectation is to add unexpected silences, even very brief ones. The brain seems to find pleasure in adjusting itself to remain synchronized with the musical beat. A sudden pause in music also transfers the responsibility for the beat to the audience, because for a moment they have to carry the tempo until the musicians resume playing. Like John Cage's work, the pause takes the focus of the music making away from the stage. The second piece in the concert that featured 4:335 was a more conventional piano sonata by Charles Ives that required no audience participation. As the pianist raced his fingers up and down the keyboard, he seemed to be trying to make up for the lack of notes in Cage's work. The piece left me entirely cold, and I kept wishing I could hear silence again. Sound mixers generally avoid complete silence in film soundtracks, with one famous exception. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick boldly used lots of quiet. If a film director attempted this nowadays, it would be the film equivalent of 4:335, and all you would hear would be endless crunching and slurping of junk food and soda by fellow cinema goers. Often when the audience thinks there is silence, there are actually quite a few audio tracks of nothing playing. Charles Dinen, head of audio for Electronic Arts, described to me how he became obsessed with silent rooms when developing a video game soundtrack. Turning up the volume on recordings that he had made in empty rooms revealed amazing creepy tones and amazing squeaking things happening. Charles also described how he might take a sound, like a camel moan, and digitally manipulate it, shifting it down many octaves and listening for distinctive tones or ringing that might appear and create the right creepiness. Game players or a film audience might not be consciously aware of these background sounds, but they are an important part of setting the emotional feel of a scene. Space, the final frontier, announces James T. Kirk at the start of the first Star Trek episode. As the spaceship Enterprise flies past the screen, the voice sounds as though it was recorded in a very reverberant cathedral. I know space is a big place, but where are the reflections meant to be coming from? And anyway, space is silent or, to quote the catchy tagline from the 1979 movie Alien, in space, no one can hear you scream. For an astronaut unfortunate enough to be caught outside the spaceship without a spacesuit, screaming to occupy the moments before asphyxiation would be pointless, as there are no air molecules to carry the sound waves. But Hollywood does not let anything as trivial as physics get in the way of a compelling soundtrack. The latest Star Trek film showed the outside of the soaring Enterprise, accompanied by lots of powerful engine noises. The photon torpedoes sounded pretty impressive as well. When I think of the inside of a real spacecraft, I picture people floating serenely and gracefully in zero gravity. I met NASA astronaut Ron Garron in early 2012, when he had just returned from a 6-month mission on board the International Space Station. He explained to me that the sonic environment in a real spacecraft is a long way from being serene. Even outside on a spacewalk, his previous mission had included a walk that lasted 6.5 hours. There is no silence. Indeed, it would have been worrying if there had been, because it would have meant that the pumps circulating air for him to breathe had stopped working. Spacecraft are full of noisy mechanical devices, such as refrigerators, air conditioning units, and fans. Theoretically, the noise could be reduced, but quieter, heavier machines would be expensive to lift into orbit. Studies on a single space shuttle flight found temporary partial deafness in the crew. Inside the International Space Station, ISS, it is so loud that some fear for the astronauts' hearing. At its worst, the noise level in sleep stations was about the same as in a very noisy office, 65 decibels. An article in New Scientist reported, astronauts on the ISS used to have to wear earplugs all day, but are now only required to wear them for 2 to 3 hours per workday. The need for earplugs, even for part of the day, indicates how hostile the soundscape is. Squidgy foam earplugs can reduce sound by about 20 to 30 decibels. The higher levels of carbon dioxide and atmospheric contaminants that exist at zero gravity in spacecraft might also make the inner ear more susceptible to noise damage. Outer space might be devoid of audible sound, but that is not true of other planets, and scientists have put microphones on spacecraft such as the Huygens probe to Saturn's moon Titan to record it. As long as a planet or moon has an atmosphere, some gas clinging to the planet, there is sound. Microphones have the advantage of being light, needing little power, and being able to hear things hidden from cameras. Mind you, the audio recorded from Titan as the Huygens probe descended through the atmosphere is not very otherworldly. It reminded me of wind rushing by an open car window while driving on a highway. However, when I consider where it was recorded, almost a billion miles away from Earth, this mundane sound feels much more exciting. If a pipe organ were taken to Mars for a performance of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, the astronauts would find the notes coming out of their musical instruments at a lower frequency. The atmosphere of Mars would transpose the music to roughly G-sharp minor. The frequency of the note produced by an organ pipe depends on the time it takes sound to travel up and down the length of the tube. Because Mars has a thin, cold atmosphere of carbon dioxide and nitrogen, sound moves at about 2/3 the speed it does on Earth. The slower round trip up and down the organ pipe produces a lower frequency. Given the toxic gases in the atmosphere, visiting astronauts would not be taking their helmets off to sing. But if someone did dare to do this, the voice would drop in pitch like the organ pipe, turning tenors into Barry White soundalikes. Unfortunately, the sexy voice would not carry very far because Mars's thin atmosphere is almost a vacuum. Venus has a very dense atmosphere, which would slow down the vibration of the astronaut's vocal folds, vocal cords, and lower the pitch of the voice. However, sound travels faster in the Venusian atmosphere, which would make the resonances of the mouth and throat rise. As a result, the astronaut's voice would sound squeaky, as happens when someone talks after breathing helium. Tim Layton, from the University of Southampton, suggests that together, these effects would make an astronaut sound like a bass smurf. Although sound levels in the International Space Station have been reduced enough that they probably no longer pose a risk to hearing, noise can affect health in other ways, and it is not just astronauts who should be concerned. For example, someone whose sleep is disturbed by airplane noise is more likely to be tired, irritable, and less effective at work the next day. If we are exposed to high levels of noise, our bodies will produce more stress hormones in the long term that might elevate blood pressure and increase the risk of heart disease. Removing noise is therefore good for us, but is a strong dose of quiet better? Should we be seeking out complete silence? One day at the office, that is, our anechoic chamber at Salford University, as the BBC tried to measure the footfall of a centipede, sound recordist Chris Watson suggested I should visit a flotation tank, a dark isolation chamber where you float in very salty water and experience sensory deprivation. And when better to experience that than a few days after hearing silence in the Mojave Desert? I headed to Venice Beach, a bohemian district of Los Angeles famous for its skimpily dressed inline skaters, outrageous street performers, and cookie poseurs. My appointment was after dark, when the place feels less free-spirited and distinctly more dangerous. I went to a tatty, closed shopping mall, and the attendant opened up the shutters to let me in. The tank was in a small shop at the back. He showed me around, giving detailed instructions on what to do, before asking me to sign a lengthy disclaimer. He then announced that I could stay as long as I wanted because he was leaving. I was told to let myself out, making sure I closed the shop door securely behind me. This was unnerving. What would happen if I fell asleep? What if I could not get out? Was I going to be stuck in a flotation tank overnight? With trepidation, I got undressed, stuck in my earplugs, showered, and wandered over to the tank. From the outside, the chamber looked like a giant industrial fridge made of metal to keep noise out, about 2.5 meters, 8 feet long, 2 meters, 7 feet high, and 1.5 meters, 5 feet wide. I climbed in, shut the door, and lay down in the body temperature shallow, salty water. The buoyancy of the brine kept me well afloat, but the angles between my head, neck, and back felt unnatural, and it took time for me to get comfortable. It was pitch black. It did not matter whether my eyes were open or closed, there was nothing to see. Lying naked in the dark, unable to hear external sounds, and in a closed, run-down shopping mall, worrying thoughts besieged me. Was the attendant a New Age version of Sweeney Todd? I turned my mind to more pleasant things and tried to relax into the experience. Provided I lay still and did not splash about, I could perceive nothing from outside. I could hear the internal high-pitched whine I had noticed in the desert, but after a while it disappeared, returning only intermittently. There was also a low-frequency, pulsating sound that sometimes seemed to make my head wobble. This was pulsatile tinnitus, where the sensitive hearing system picks up the rhythmic pumping of blood. It's similar to the sensation you get when the heart starts pounding during intensive exercise. Normally, this blood movement is quieter than the everyday external sounds passing down the ear canal, but in the flotation tank with earplugs, this pulsing sign of life became audible. I heard it only occasionally, and most of the time I could hear nothing at all. To appreciate this total silence, I had to shut up the voice in my head and stop myself from listening for sounds. This is not easy to do, because the brain constantly directs attention in anticipation of hearing something. In a neuroimaging study, Julien Voisin and colleagues found increased activity in the auditory cortex during the silence before a sound was heard. The effect of cutting off both hearing and vision, and the feeling of the hot, salty water on my skin, made me very aware of touch. After a while, I got the impression that my legs and arms had disappeared, and my feet and hands were detached from my body. They felt slightly numb, like the sensation you get just before pins and needles sets in. It is hard to articulate the sound experience because it was all about an absence of hearing. This was probably the nearest to a truly perceived silence I have heard, because for long periods my sense of hearing seemed to be completely missing, to the point that my only sense seemed to be touch. I decided it was time to finish. I struggled to my feet and groped around for the door handle. Outside of the chamber, I checked my watch and was flabbergasted that I had been floating for 2 hours. I showered, dressed, let myself out of the shop, and sat in my car feeling very weak and queasy, probably because I was badly dehydrated. The flotation tank is supposed to help with stress management by lowering levels of cortisol, but in my shaky state, I was not at all sure it had worked for me. Going to the countryside and getting some peace and quiet is meant to be good for us, but rural places are usually far from silent. Within a crowded and intensely farmed country, it is difficult to escape the sounds of agriculture and human activity. Media stories about newcomers to the countryside complaining about noise appear each year like perennial weeds. The mayor of a French village has forbidden complaints about farmyard noises in a preemptive strike against a growing number of urban newcomers prepared to sue for their right to rural peace. City dwellers intending to join the 300 inhabitants of Cesny-aux-Vignes, 12 miles from Caen in Normandy, have been asked to cohabit with crowing cockerels, braying donkeys or chiming church bells without complaint. But those people aren't alone in imagining the ideal countryside through rose-tinted ears. I conjure up pastoral sounds, the bleating of sheep in fields, the trickle of water running down a stream, and the thwack of leather on willow at a village cricket match. I am not a particularly nostalgic person, but, rather startlingly, I have just painted a scene from a P.G. Wodehouse novel, Tales of England from 100 years ago, with the bumbling aristocrat Bertie Wooster and astute butler Jeeves. Take a moment to think of your ideal rural soundscape. What would you like to hear? I would be surprised if you picked complete silence, because most people go to the countryside to feel connected with nature. Gordon Hempton, a sound recordist and acoustic ecologist from Washington State, has been campaigning for the preservation of natural silence, which is as necessary and essential as species preservation, habitat restoration, toxic waste cleanup, and carbon dioxide reduction. Gordon Hempton claims that there are very few remaining quiet places in the US, even though the country has large tracts of empty land. True freedom from man-made sounds is surprisingly hard to achieve because of the web of flight paths that crisscross the sky. Hempton has named one niche that is free from aircraft noise as 1 square inch of silence, and says this is the quietest place in the United States. It is located in the Ho Rainforest in Olympic National Park, Washington State. But there is not a complete absence of sound. Although the location is free from man-made noises, there are plenty of natural sounds to listen to in this enchanting rainforest. The lush, green canopy of ancient coniferous and deciduous trees, with mosses and ferns blanketing the surfaces, is home to noisy animals and birds, and the high level of rainfall produces lots of river noises. Imagine if it were truly silent. So the rapid staccato notes of the winter wren were missing, and no Douglas squirrel was crying, "Pililui!" This would be a barren and lifeless place. Murray Schaefer, the pioneering acoustic ecologist who evangelizes about ear cleaning, praises rural settings and calls them a hi-fi soundscape. A good quality audio system reproduces sound with little or no unwanted noise. This fact led Schaefer to define a hi-fi soundscape as being a place where the hearing system is not overwhelmed by undesirable noise, making useful, relatively subtle sonic information more audible. In contrast, he defined a lo-fi soundscape as one where individual sounds are masked by the rumble of traffic and other man-made noises. The U.S. National Park Service has a policy that states, "The service will restore to the natural condition wherever possible those park soundscapes that have become degraded by unnatural sounds, noise, and will protect natural soundscapes from unacceptable impacts." The Campaign to Protect Rural England, CPRE, claims that half the people visiting the countryside do it to find tranquility. Access to tranquility has been shown to reduce stress. The three competing theories as to why natural sounds might be good for us were outlined in Chapter 3. Research commissioned by the CPRE found that seeing a natural landscape, hearing birdsong, and seeing the stars were the top three things contributing to a sense of tranquility. Unwanted features included hearing constant traffic noise, seeing lots of people, and urban development. As these findings show, tranquility is not just about sound. It includes being calm and free of disturbance, including consideration of how a place looks. It requires our senses to be in harmony and not to have competing and conflicting stimuli. In science, the different senses are often studied in isolation, but our brains do not take such a demarcated approach. Although we sometimes use different regions of our brains to process and interpret signals from our various senses, the overall emotional response comes from an aggregation of what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. Michael Hunter from the University of Sheffield and collaborators have shown how the brain handles sensory inputs in tranquil and non-tranquil places using a functional magnetic resonance imaging fMRI scanner. Ingeniously, they used an ambiguous sound recording in all the tests. Waves crashing on a beach sound remarkably like light road traffic, and just changed the picture to make people think they were listening to something different. The natural scene of the beach increased connectivity between the auditory cortex and other parts of the brain. The increase in connectivity did not happen with the man-made highway. The results show that what we are looking at affects which neural pathways are used to process sound. When we're evaluating tranquility, we must consider sound and vision together. The author Sarah Maitland has gone to great lengths to find tranquility and solitude. Chosen silence can be creative and generate self-knowledge, integration, and profound joy. She moved to a remote cottage, cut off communication with others, and removed the TV, clothes dryer, and as many other noisy appliances as she could. Maitland writes about the sense of spirituality that her silent existence has given her. Others have also referred to rural tranquility in hushed, almost reverential language. Indeed, surveys have linked quiet, natural places and a sense of spirituality. A tranquil soundscape has a quality and emotional connection similar to that found in churches. People become very sensitive to the sounds around them, but not in a stressful way. Maybe this sense of spirituality simply reflects the reduced cognitive load on the brain, which experiences less stress when processing the calmer soundscape. To keep our hearing open to possible signs of danger, our brains have to constantly work to suppress unchanging noises, such as the perpetual drone of traffic. This situation is not conducive to finding a relaxed and spiritual sense of well-being. The CPRE has even quantified tranquility, publishing brightly coloured, blotchy maps of England that define areas by how tranquil they are. Researchers calculated a tranquility index by working out what people might see by measuring lines of sight to natural and man-made features, and also what they might hear through predictions of noise levels from roads and aircraft. When I looked up my home city on the map, I found it to be a sea of red, signifying no tranquility. Then my eye was drawn toward dark green areas farther north, just below the Scottish border, indicating large tracts of tranquil countryside. Somewhere in the green areas was the most tranquil place in England, and I decided I wanted to visit it. But when the original research had been published a few years earlier, the CPRE had been coy about the exact coordinates of the most tranquil place, not wishing it to be ruined by visitors. So I was surprised and delighted when I was granted access to the original mapping data so that I could pinpoint the location just outside Northumberland National Park, near Kildare Forest. The place would not be easy to reach, because by definition it was far from buildings, infrastructure and roads. A few months after returning from the desert, I sorted out the logistics and started by cycling as close as possible on the nearest road. It was the start of autumn, and I was either too cold in the deep shadows cast by conifer forests, or out of breath and too hot climbing up hills in full sun. I travelled through countryside typical of northern England, rolling hills with fields being grazed by sheep and cattle bordered by dry stone walls. As I gained more height, the most tranquil place is almost at the top of a hill, I entered scrubby moorland with army tanks in the middle of a firing range. I now realized why this place has very little human infrastructure on civilian maps. Strange that the place rated as being very tranquil is where the gunners of fighter planes are often trained. I turned my mountain bike off the road and onto forest trails, trying to get as close as possible to the most tranquil spot. I parked my bike, put on walking boots, and started the long trudge cross-country. As I left the trees behind, I entered one of the Kildare Mires, the local name for peat bogs covered in moss and heather. The ground was very uneven, and my feet kept disappearing into dips and gullies and getting soaked. I had previously thought of asking the CPRE if I could publish the location of the quietest place, but I now realized this would be a bad idea. If lots of people put this on their rambling bucket list, then this delicate wetland terrain would be damaged. Fortunately, no one was logging in the forest, and the military were having a day off. It really was incredibly quiet, with the only sound coming from my pounding heart, heavy breathing, and rhythmic squelching from my boots. After an hour, I judged I had reached the final location, and I turned on my phone to check the GPS coordinates. A beep announced the arrival of a text message. There was no other sound, no visible sign of human activity, and yet I had decent mobile phone reception. To capture tranquility, I decided to try my sound recording equipment. Even with the gain on my recorder turned up to its highest setting, there was nothing to be captured apart from the dull background hiss of electrical noise from within the equipment, and the occasional flapping sound as I tried to kill the midges that were feasting on me. Just then, a few birds flew by in the distance, calling out using rapid staccato chirps, and quickly disappeared before I could spot what they were. This was not a very serene, rejuvenating, or relaxing silence. I was exhausted, my feet were drenched, and I was unable to sit down in the wet peat bog. The mild anxiety that the military might turn up and arrest me for trespassing did not help. But I was surprised and impressed that I had found a complete silence in the English countryside. For me, the lack of animal sounds detracted from the experience, reminding me that the surrounding monoculture of conifer trees is not good for biodiversity. Complete silence in a natural setting is not necessarily wonderful. I wanted to hear birds or the trickle of a stream. Even a buzzing fly would have been good. Some sound that signified life. More than half the world's population now lives in cities. Is it possible to find some form of tranquility in an urban environment? Engineers have been working hard to make cars quieter, but with more traffic on the road, average noise levels in cities have stayed the same. And considering only an average of the noise level overlooks a crucial trend. As motorists try to avoid traffic by leaving for work before or after rush hour, their noise pollutes peaceful times of the day. As drivers try to avoid gridlock, they turn calm back roads into rat runs, ruining quiet places. Although cities thrive on human activity, vibrancy, and excitement, people need relatively quiet places for respite from the hustle and bustle. Policymakers are interested in how tranquil refuges can be preserved, but achieving such protection is turning out to be difficult. The ideal would be to craft a simple metric that could be measured on a sound level meter or predicted in a computer model. A scientific report once suggested that areas with sound levels below 55 decibels, a level you might hear from a cheap refrigerator, should be designated quiet areas. Another, that man-made sound should be below 42 decibels, a typical level for a library. By those criteria, there are no tranquil areas in major cities like London, which is nonsense. Like all world capitals, London is a noisy place. But turn a corner and go down a back street, and often you find a quiet square where noise is distant and less intrusive. This just illustrates the problem of trying to reduce human perceptions to simple numbers. In a city, what matters is relative quiet rather than absolute loudness. As in the countryside, man-made sounds need suppressing, but they do not have to be inaudible. Songbirds, rustling leaves, and moving water need encouraging, because studies have shown that tranquility in towns is greater when natural sounds are louder. Other senses need to be considered. Research suggests that places with more hard landscaping need to be quieter than greener refuges, and certain smells, especially the stench of street urination, do not aid tranquility. How might you make such an acoustic oasis? Layout is very important because a noise source out of sight is usually quieter. The piazza in front of the British Library in London is an interesting example. Facing onto a very busy street, it is still possible to find some quiet in the pedestrianised square because a high wall hides the road. Unfortunately, bass sound carries over the wall more easily than higher frequencies, so the rumble of waiting buses is still overpowering from time to time. But a higher wall placed closer to the road could solve this problem. In quiet back streets, it is actually the buildings that often act as barriers to noise. Hildegard Westerkamp, a world-renowned composer, radio artist, and sound ecologist from Canada, explained to me on the London Sound Walk that this quiet stone sound of backstreets is heard only in old cities where roads are narrow and buildings close together. In North America, where most of the streets are wide, it is also hard to escape the hum and whine of ventilation fans. Since lowering sound levels at the source is the most effective strategy, having fewer, slower cars is good, as is reducing rolling noise through better asphalt and tire design. As for promoting desirable sounds, water features and fountains create likeable babble and splash that can also mask unwanted traffic noise. Hong Kong is incredibly crowded and noisy. Even so, close to the centre there is a park with a giant aviary where man-made sounds are completely absent, and the songs of the birds can be enjoyed. The traffic noise is inaudible because the babbling of a stream helps hide the sound of the roads. Sheffield in northern England was at the heart of the UK steel industry and famed for its high-quality cutlery. Nowadays it may be better known as the setting of the film The Full Monty, a black comedy about former steelworkers, unemployed and desperate for money, forming a striptease act. At Sheffield train station there is an enormous fountain. It is on a size and scale that I expect to see only on the grounds of a grand, stately home. I travelled to Sheffield often and had noticed this huge water feature being built, but I did not realise the subtleties of the acoustic design until they were pointed out to me by Jian Kang, a soundscape guru from one of the local universities. The high-sided walls of shimmering water serve as a noise barrier shielding the square from traffic. In addition, a series of large pools stretches downhill with water flowing between them. If you stand in the right place, the waterfalls between the pools imitate the chuff-chuff sound of steam trains because the water stops and starts. This irregular flow draws more attention because it is harder to tune out intermittent sounds than continuous ones. The fountain makes the traffic less perceptible by both physically blocking the sound and generating pleasant, distracting water sounds. I talked to a colleague from Salford University, Bill Davies, about the large research project he had conducted investigating positive sound design in cities. Appropriately, he is the most soft-spoken person I have ever met, so quiet that his speech becomes almost inaudible at times. Bill and his collaborators took people on sound walks and asked them about their impressions of city squares. They also played sounds to subjects in the laboratory and asked which ones they preferred. The results showed that vibrancy and pleasantness are important. A busy piazza can be buzzing with people, yet there is a pleasant calmness if you are slightly distant, say in a cafe on the edge of the square watching the crowd go by. This may be true even if cars are present. In contrast, a city square that is little more than a traffic rotary lacks the babble of the crowds. The noise from cars is just unchanging and unpleasant. Researchers have demonstrated the health benefits of natural sounds, but I think Bill's finding on vibrancy and pleasantness indicates that scientists are overlooking an important sound that could also be good for us. Perhaps hearing human activity reduces stress. The quiet chatter of people in a cafe is relaxing and not too alerting. Furthermore, one should have a positive emotional response to being surrounded by other people in a friendly atmosphere. After all, being a social animal has been a vital part of our evolutionary success. Maybe this is an avenue for future research. One thing is certain: perception of silence is highly subjective. In Kildare Forest, I felt there should have been natural sounds, and the lack of them made the place seem barren. On the Mojave Dunes, the enveloping silence seemed appropriate and peaceful. Looking out over the vast, barren valley, I could imagine the complete quiet extending for miles. The silence waxed and waned as the wind came and went, creating a gentle whooshing past my ears, or the occasional insect buzzed, or I heard the beating sound of bird wings. These oral accents made the silence seem very natural. An ex-colleague of mine, Stuart Bradley from Auckland University, has visited Antarctica, another place devoid of vegetation where silence can be heard. Stuart is a tall New Zealander, sporting a fine moustache like a soccer player from the 1970s. Ironically, what Stuart does in Antarctica is make noise and briefly ruin the pristine natural soundscape. He uses a sodar, a sound radar system, to measure weather conditions, sending up strange chirps that bounce off of turbulent air in the atmosphere before returning to the ground to be measured. I asked Stuart if he had experienced silence in Antarctica, and he told me about his time in the dry valleys, possibly the most barren places on Earth, which lack snow and ice cover. Sitting up on the valley wall on a still day, there was no sound I could identify, except heartbeat, breathing. No life apart from me. So no leaves either, no running water, no wind noise. I was certainly struck by the primeval feel. Stuart commented on how different this was to the sound of a silent laboratory. I didn't get the claustrophobic feel one can get in an anechoic chamber. I suspect this is because, although it was incredibly quiet, it was also a very, very open vista. The valley walls were 1,500 to 2,000 meters, 5,000 to 6,500 feet high, and the visibility was amazing. Getting away from normal existence and civilization is an important part of silent retreats. John Drever, the acoustic ecologist who had taken me to hear bitterns, Chapter 3, suggested that I needed to experience a retreat to truly understand silence. So I signed up for 3 days of Buddhism in an 18th century manor house out in the English countryside for a month before I went into the desert. Only when I arrived did I realize that this Buddhist weekend would involve 15 meditations a day, challenging my inflexible middle-aged body to adopt an unfamiliar posture for hours. It was a great relief when the gong sounded to end each backaching session. I needed to have done some training to be better prepared for the static gymnastics. Just before silence started on the first day, we were asked to tell a fellow retreatant why we were there. I said I was researching silence for a book. My fellow retreatant announced she was struggling with a bereavement, and then we were told to be silent. That bombshell, that glimpse into her heart, was left hanging in the air for 3 days. The only two words I said in the next 12 hours were, "Compost bin," as I searched the kitchen during my work hour. The only other talking I did over the following 3 days was during two brief question and answer sessions with the teachers. On the first evening, I was struck by how odd it was going around the house without talking. There were about 50 of us, so I was constantly passing people in the corridors, or waiting in line for food and the bathrooms, but no words were exchanged. I did more smiling at strangers in 1 day than I normally do in a whole month, but eye contact alone seemed odd and awkward. Sitting down to our simple Buddhist meal of split pea soup and whole wheat bread, maybe not the best choices for maintaining bodily silence, I found myself directly opposite a woman in her mid-40s. I did not know where to look. We were close enough to be invading each other's space, but being unable to say hello made the proximity seem exceptionally intrusive. It was weird not being able to engage in small talk. The retreat teachers encouraged us to find comforting community in the shared experience and something supportive in the silence. For me, however, it was a struggle, and I had a strong feeling of cold isolation. The room where we meditated was the size of a small church, and we sat or knelt in regimented rows on mats. Everyone had a personalized nest shaped from cushions, blankets, and tiny wooden stools to make the sitting more bearable. At the front, the teacher sat mostly in silence, occasionally giving instruction. As I settled down for the first sitting, I realized that not only was I physically ill-prepared, but I also did not know how to meditate. "How do you know you have a body, right now? How is your breath?" the teacher queried precisely and slowly. I learned self-hypnosis 20 years ago, and around the same time, I had practiced the Alexander technique to improve my posture. So I did my best to meditate by mingling these techniques with hints picked up from the teacher. The teacher asked how we knew we were inhabiting a body. Apart from discomfort and breathing, the awareness came from the sounds around me. This was hardly a silent retreat. Above the meditation hall was a large rookery, and the loud squawks and squeals as the rooks fed their chicks rang out across the hall, interspersed with the soft warbling tones of blackbirds and the cooing of wood pigeons. Less poetic was the gurgling pipework from stomachs and radiators, and coughs as people cleared their throats. As I was to learn over the next few days, part of meditation is accepting these sounds and incorporating them into the practice. On the way to the retreat, I had read some scientific papers about how brain networks are altered by mindfulness techniques, and these accounts helpfully described the stages of focused attention meditation, which I then copied. You start with a focus, say your breath passing through the nostrils. Inevitably, your mind wanders. When you become aware of being distracted, you need to shift attention back to the focus. Different brain regions are involved in each of these stages. In an experiment carried out by Wendy Hassenkamp, subjects meditated for 20 minutes in an fMRI scanner to measure brain activity. The subjects were asked to press a button whenever they realized their mind had wandered, before returning to their breath focus. Experienced meditators had more connectivity across networks of brain regions that might be used for maintaining attention and avoiding distraction. This increased connectivity might have been in place before the people started their years of practice, in which case it might be evidence that they were well suited for meditation. Alternatively, it could be evidence that meditation changes neural structures. Attention is not just important to meditation. It plays an important role in cognitive processing. Many aspects of it, alerting, disengaging, reorienting, maintaining attention, are also useful elsewhere in life. Having survived the first few meditations, I grabbed a quick barley and chicory coffee substitute, I bet your mouth is watering, and retired to the lounge. It was like a dreadful retirement home when the television is broken. Chairs were pushed against the walls, and we all sat there staring at our cups, at the walls, or through the windows into the darkening green hills outside. I decided to go to bed early. I was sharing a room with two strangers, and I could not even say goodnight. It was like a scene from a 1970s sitcom where a marriage had gone wrong, or in this case, a same-sex three-way civil partnership. We padded around the bedroom, not looking at each other or talking, passing like ships in the night. For some, there is joy in this communal silence, the freedom from having to put on an act. The silence creates anonymity, since you do not know people's names, where they come from, what jobs they do, and so on. Taking a break from being mindful at breakfast, I glanced around and tried to guess who everyone was, but the loose, formless meditation clothes offered few hints. A young man sat in a fleece sarong and woolly hat. A 30-something woman had a tie-dyed top and leggings. And an older man sported a goatee and looked as though he played in a traditional jazz group. It was like living in a Whole Foods shop. Half of the sessions were walking meditations, which were better outside, even when it was drizzling and cold. The idea was, while walking, to notice how the feet struck the ground and how the lower legs moved and were braced for each step. A cyclist passed on the lane just outside the grounds and stared as the retreatants walked purposefully and incredibly slowly in random directions. Adding to the chorus of birdsong, a malevolent hum came from a tree in full blossom as insects buzzed about pollinating and wing-beat noise was just above my head. Maintaining silence between meditation sessions encourages continuous mindfulness. At the time, I was so busy being mindful that it was hard to judge what effect all this silence might be having on me. Only after leaving the retreat did I notice the effects. The sandwich I bought at the railway station while traveling home tasted exceptionally strong. The idea that meditation can change basic perception is gaining traction in the scientific literature, although not many results are available yet, and there is nothing on taste or sound. Catherine McLean and collaborators have looked at one aspect of vision, testing people on a 3-month Buddhist Samatha meditation retreat in a remote mountain setting in Colorado. They had retreatants look at different sized white lines on a black screen and categorize each line as long or short. By the end of the retreat, compared to a control group, retreatants had improved their ability to discriminate different line lengths, and 5 months later, they still demonstrated improved acuity. My family laughed at me when I arrived home from the retreat, because I spoke in an uncharacteristically soft voice and walked about at a snail's pace. Immediately after the retreat, I felt it had been an interesting experience, but not one to repeat. In the weeks and months that followed, however, I had a lingering desire to spend another weekend in that noisy silence, to take the time to rediscover the peaceful state in which I had arrived home.